Okay, this is session 31, and it's March 5th, 2007, and side one, and we're finally done with William Irwin Thompson. We've done McLuhan before Thompson, and we've done half, two-thirds of LaRouche, but we're going to go on to Arthur Croker, the fourth writer.
Well, we're going to actually begin reading Croker from your book. We sort of, as a bridge, were sort of talking about Croker and the other guys during the last session anyway.
Yeah, and now we're dealing with the actual pages with Croker quotes. And then we're going to go back to LaRouche and finish up with LaRouche, but as we finish up LaRouche, we'll be relating his work with Croker, McLuhan, and Thompson, which you have heard in completion. And so we'll get back to LaRouche after we complete Croker. So the first, now with Croker, we have big chunks of text. So we're going to read them paragraph by paragraph. But, for example, this upcoming one has four paragraphs. LaRouche was like that, but there's a lot of density in Croker. So when Scott reads a paragraph, it's not the complete quote. But we will then do that, and then do the next paragraph, and then the next paragraph, and then the fourth paragraph in this case, and then go through it all, or maybe I'll read it all through fast after we've done each one. Okay?
Okay.
After we've done each paragraph.
Right.
So this is from Croker's very most well-known book called The Postmodern Scene that came out in 1986. It's called The Postmodern Scene, subtitled Excremental Culture and Hyper Aesthetics. And Croker had his own press in Montreal because he was teaching at Concordia University in Montreal, and the press was called New World Perspectives. And this was jointly done with a University of Toronto professor, an expert on Northrop Frye, a longtime friend of Arthur Croker named David Cook. So this is a lot of this stuff is written by Croker. Cook writes stuff in the book, too, but we're selecting the Croker sections. So this is page, in the introduction, page 1 and 2 of the introduction, or preface, before you get the actual page 1, 2, 3, 4. This is Roman numeral 1 and Roman numeral 2 in the postmodern scene.
Okay, Scott, when was it written?
1986 it came out.
Okay. And in this first bit that I'm going to read, he references the term the postmodern scene, and it's all in bold print. Every time he references it, I think to distinguish that he's talking about his book as opposed to the postmodern scene.
Yeah, this is a description of his own book. These first quotes are describing the postmodern scene, but how his book, The Postmodern Scene, approaches the postmodern scene, which by the middle 80s has become dominant in academia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in large part of the humanities, part of academia, postmodern writers.
So to begin, the postmodern scene evokes and then secretes the fin de millennium mood of contemporary culture.
It's the end of millennium mood.
Mm-hmm.
French, you know, fin
right.
La fin.
Yeah.
On the millennium mood of contemporary culture.
Right. It's a panic book. Panic sex, panic art, panic ideology, panic bodies, panic noise, and panic theory. Indeed, the text itself should be read as imminently postmodern.
And imminently means pervasively, like through and through, not imminently as if it's going to come in from the future.
Mm-hmm.
Something's imminent, it's coming in the future time. This means imminently, I-M-M-A-N-E-N-T-L-Y, means pervades. So this book is imminently or pervasively permeated by the postmodern spirit.
Mm-hmm. That's, for example, while Adorno or Horkheimer's Dialectic of Enlightenment was written in response to the outbreak of the fascist mind, the postmodern scene is written in response to the outbreak, again, of the Dialectic of Enlightenment. In an age where computers reify the meaning of memory and panic sex is the language of the postmodern body, then it may still be salutary to meditate anew on historical remembrance as the basis of politics. The postmodern scene, while thriving in the detrital scenes,
that means detritus, garbage.
Right.
While thriving in the detrital scenes
of cultural amnesia, is also a market of remembrance.
Think Reagan. Remember, this is the time of the Reagan era.
Mm-hmm.
President Reagan.
Decay/ecstasy, hyper-pessimism/hyper-optimism, memory/amnesia, these are the double signs under which this text has been written. If this sounds paradoxical, ambivalent, and contradictory, this just means that, like the quantum age which it seeks to describe, the postmodern scene is a quantum, that is to say, postmodern, sign of its times.
So the book itself is a quantum phenomenon mirroring the quantum age, which is his term for the postmodern age.
Yeah. So that requires a bit of an investigation as to, you know, what he means is his book is you know, quantum, and but in the sense that it's a metaphor for Einstein's quantum explorations into quantum physics. Or
well, he's Coker is a student of McLuhan. He's also by this time an expert on Jean Baudrillard, who talks about the simulacrum, at least in his early writings, and then Paul Virilio, two McLuhan students. Paul Virilio talks about the aesthetics of disappearance. Deleuze and Guattari. Well, let's just say Virilio and Baudrillard at this point. The thing is that they're describing, in McLuhan terms, the discarnate post-chemical body environment. And so Baudrillard said that when physicists are describing matter as subatomic particles, they're really sociologists describing the actual conditions for humans technologically, how they live. And so McLuhan would say, yes, the discarnate is expressed by visually biased physicists as subatomic particles, but they're really describing second nature, the effect of the radio and TV and computer environment, not first nature. So Coker recognizes that Baudrillard and Virilio are working with that McLuhan insight, and it's Baudrillard who kind of is the main sociologist, since he comes out of that tradition, whereas Virilio is an investigator of military technology by profession. Baudrillard, as a sociologist, is seeing that the quantum physics metaphors or principles are metaphors describing the present disembodied world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, you know, which came first? Did theoretical physicists conceive of while putting the laws of nature under their microscopes, and then come up with equations that electrical engineers could then turn into electrical communication devices, which then mirrored the quantum realm, or did we come up with an electrical environment that created the idea in the mind of physicists of how to conceptualize, you know, the subatomic world, you know, is a chicken or the egg kind of question, or maybe a coevolutionary.
Yeah, well, McLuhan sides with the chicken was the egg's way of getting more eggs, and so sides with the egg, but in his history of technology, he takes the principle the effects precede the causes, and he says the telegraph age moved man into the discarnate, and therefore, a generation or two later, the quantum physicists start coming in.
Mm-hmm.
What's their name? forget the guy, at the time of Einstein, Max Ernst, is it? No, that's the painter. His name's Mach, Ernst Mach, M-A-C-H. And then there's Einstein and then Heisenberg and the rest of them. They come in 1900 to 1930. But you've had the telegraph for 50 years before that.
Mm-hmm. The quark
stuff that comes later is almost describing maybe the radio or TV effect.
Anyway,
yeah,
well,
it's all lumped in as quantum mechanics, you know.
Right. Well, yeah, and then in the realm of quantum mechanics, time and space gets smeared, and maybe...
Yeah, the visual boundaries of absolute time and absolute space of Newton become blurred.
Mm-hmm.
Because technologically, we've moved beyond visual coordinates of time and space.
Yeah.
You got the telephone, two places at once at the same time. It's like an electron, two places at once.
An electron's at two places at once?
Yeah, and the user of the telephone is in at least two places at once.
What is the electron in two places at once?
Well, that was the theories around the time of the Copenhagen conference. And in 1927, they were speculating. Of course, it was all, nobody believed it, nobody understood it, or they didn't know how to judge it. But over the last 30, 40 years, they start to say, yeah, we've proven electrons in two places at once.
Yeah, that's kind of according to the Heisenberg uncertainty.
Yeah, that's the beginning of that. But by the 80s and 90s, they're saying, yeah, we've got the instruments, we've measured it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you always get the argument among the theoreticians of physics versus the engineers or practical technicians of physics, and they always disagree about where they are at, what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So people now popularize quantum theory. They do it in New Age books. They do it all over the place. And they're taking one aspect of the theory, but if you actually talk to one school of science or physicists, they say, no, that's none of that stuff. The idea of the Heisenberg principle is not what people think it is.
Yeah.
And then they come up with some other variation.
Yeah. Well, the leading thinkers around this idea of, is it a particle or is it a wave, or is it existing in two places, the electron existing in two places simultaneously. I heard this brilliant guy talking about that. He says that they're actually, and I think this is a result of their ventures into string theory, coming to believe, well, everyone's familiar with the popular notion of parallel realities, that the electron doesn't actually exist in any particular time and space until the waveform's been collapsed through the observation.
Yeah.
And then when it's seen in two places at the same time, the belief is that it's actually not in two places in one dimension of space and time, but they're actually seeing a bleed through from a parallel dimension. So they're seeing where it exists in our time space, and then they're seeing it a bleed through of it, of the same electron bleeding through from a parallel reality, but it actually doesn't exist in two places.
Right.
At the same time.
Yeah. Now that, I think that's a later refinement. But that's another school of thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be a later refinement.
It's another way to look at it, and of course they're always arguing over that. So the very postmodern condition is one that's paradoxical, ambivalent, and contradictory.
Mm-hmm.
As he describes, this just means that the quantum age, which it seeks to describe, is a quantum and is postmodern.
Yeah.
It is.
So it doesn't conform to Plato's ideals of reason on the logos and all like that.
No, that's visually biased. We have a rational view of things. This begins with contradiction.
Right.
And then as you explore or try to tease apart the contradictions, you remain ambivalent about what you're accomplishing.
Mm-hmm.
So Madonna ends up saying, so I contradict myself. You know, by the end of the 20th century, the popular culture starts to express these technological environmental effects themselves in their own experience, not just by physicists trying to define what first nature is.
Yeah, the visual space guy doesn't like the contradictions because he sees it as being an inconsistency, and
yeah,
you're not being, you know,
logical, rational, maintaining a single lane of thought, single line of thought, or lane that leads to efficient industry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hardware industry.
Well, yeah.
You don't need to be that kind of person when you're experiencing rock music or any kind of radio entertainment, jazz on up or jazz on down. You need new kinds of variations of sound, new what Wyndham Lewis called a dithyrambic spectator. So you need to be irrational to keep the radio industry going.
Mm-hmm.
And then became the video industry. And anybody understands that now.
Mm-hmm.
Entertainment from anybody's traditional idea, depending on when they were born in the 20th century, eventually has to confront the fact that entertainment has gone way beyond what they thought would be considered entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up with the description of our time, as Croker says, garbage scenes of cultural amnesia, where you market remembrance, and the citizen is in a state of decay and ecstasy, hyper-pessimism, hyper-optimism, and memory amnesia at the same time. Double signs.
Uh-huh.
And this leads to panic everything.
Uh-huh.
Which, since the phase you're identifying with may not last very long, like a quantum particle, very short life, you're going to be in a state of panic to accomplish those situations.
Uh-huh.
So reading this again, you can see what I mean. He says, the postmodern scene, the book, evokes and then secretes the end of the millennium mood of contemporary culture. It's a panic book. Panic sex, panic art, panic ideology, panic bodies, panic noise, and panic theory. Indeed, the text itself should be read as imminently postmodern. In other words, it's a panic book. Thus, for example, while Adorno and Horkheimer's book, Dialectic Enlightenment, and that was written in the late 40s, was written in response to the outbreak of the fascist mind, they were trying to understand the Holocaust and World War II, the postmodern scene is written in response to the outbreak again of the Dialectic of Enlightenment. Now, the Dialectic of Enlightenment was what Adorno and Horkheimer, who were part of the Frankfurt School of generally Marxist theoreticians, many of them had to leave Germany in the 30s and end up in the United States, New York City, and universities. The postmodern scene is written in response to the outbreak again of the Dialectic of Enlightenment. The Dialectic of Enlightenment is what caused the Holocaust. It's the thesis of Adorno and Horkheimer. The Enlightenment was a bad phase. Now, McLuhan would say the Enlightenment was just visual space, you know, hyped up in newspaper and early industry terms. So,
Another term for Enlightenment would be the Age of Reason.
Right.
Yeah.
The Dialectic of Enlightenment and Revolution, French Revolution, American Revolution, that period in the 1700s, Croker is seeing that being retrieved in the 80s, and that's not good to the degree that he uses value judgment. He's going to critique it. So the outbreak of the fascist mind is what Adorno and Horkheimer responded to, but the retrieval of the Dialectic of Enlightenment, which could be maybe neoliberalism and neoconservatism.
See, he probably sees that as the tight-ass fundamentalist guy who wants to control to the point of being, you know, sadomasochistic.
Are you saying a fundamentalist?
Yeah, the guy that wants to, you know, he wants to control reality.
Well, that would be maintaining a rational point of view, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, visual bias, but the...
But it sort of turns the human being into a machine. You know, ultimately you push control to its logical conclusion. You have somebody that's like, you know...
You're using the idea that the machine is a bad thing. Croker's not going there. It's actually the Enlightenment is the idea that we can humanize the machine. That's where the chemical body comes in, you know. They start saying, okay, we're just stimulus and response mechanisms, you know, the Skinner box. and other kinds of psychologies in the early 20th century, this gets turned around after after the 70s, into this is not a problem. This is healthy.
And wasn't the Stepford Wives come out like in the
'70s? But well, the Stepford Wives is a put down. The dialectic of Enlightenment theoreticians would be everybody that that the counterculture was angry about because Reagan brought in the idea of free trade, globalization. That's the dialectic of Enlightenment. And it's thinking that this will improve everyone's life, just like the Enlightenment in 1700s laid out humanist ideals of improvement. And Adorno of social improvement, equal rights for all humans, and get rid of slavery. And then how did it end up into the slave camps of Nazi Germany? How come a culture like Germany, which comes out of the dialectic of comes out of the Enlightenment era, how come it ends up in contradiction? That's the question Adorno and Horkheimer were working with. Now, the postmodern scene now says, well, the dialectic of Enlightenment has forgotten what its disservices and now begins again in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So in an age where computers reify, materialize the meaning of memory, and panic sets the language of the postmodern body would be the discarnate body, then it may still be salutary or healthy to meditate anew on historical remembrance as the basis of politics. It means bring back a comprehensive view of history, if Croker means himself. He has said in interviews that he's about, you know, remembering what happened, and it'd be the basis of a political action or political praxis.
Yeah,
postmodern scene, while thriving in cultural amnesia, is also a market of remembrance. That's what Reagan was. That's what everything is. They called the 80s the rerun decade, whereas the 70s was the me decade.
In a culture of amnesia, you can promote whatever kind of remembrance you want, so you can manufacture the past.
Yes, you have historical revisionism. Then you have people denying the Holocaust. You have people claiming that their race was not rewarded economically. The Japanese demanded reparations for concentration camps in America in the 40s. The African Americans want reparations. You start redoing history, or the image of what I would call visual space, in McLuhan terms, history, and remodulating who's the victim, who's the champion, and then having agreements within that.
Mm-hmm.
It's all part of the postmodern scene.
Mm-hmm.
Since we can't perceive the quantum present, we obsess about the past, like that TV show Roots came in the late 70s. That helped establish the media image of political correctness, at least in relation to the African-American culture.
Yeah.
And then you have women demanding rights right when they don't have chemical bodies really anymore. They have postmodern bodies. We're going to see Croker comment on the feminist movement. His wife is the one who brings in and writes about that, Mary Louise Croker.
Mm-hmm.
So shall we go on to the next paragraph?
Okay. I was just going to mention this was written in 86, so the punk scene was really full-blown, right?
Yeah.
That's an expression of panic emotion.
Panic music.
Yeah.
But, you know, Croker himself had a punk band in the late 80s.
Oh, didn't know that.
Yeah. I don't know how often they play, but he writes about playing in different places and having unruly audiences, different confrontational scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's read the next paragraph.
For who now can speak with confidence of the postmodern scene, what is truly fascinating for catastrophe, and where what drives onward economy, politics, culture, sex, and even eating, not the will to emulate the search for lost coherencies, but just the opposite, the ecstatic implosion of postmodern culture into excess, waste, and disaccumulation. The technology of the quantum order produces human beings who are part metal, part flesh, when robo-beings constitute the growing majority of a Western culture, which fulfills, then exceeds, Weber's grim prophecy of the coming age of, quote, specialists without spirit,
end quote.
Unquote. And when chip technology finally makes possible the fateful fusion of molecular biology and technique, then ours is genuinely a postmodern condition marked by the deepest and most pathological symptoms of nihilism.
Nihilism.
Yeah. Not just science as the will to power, but also medicine as an empty will to knowledge. In parentheses, of the lacerated body.
Chemical body.
Mm-hmm. Penology, which is has to do with penal systems, right?
Yeah.
Penology is a grisly will to surveillance of the body politic, and ethics itself is enucleated within the dynamic language of instrumental activism. The postmodern scene is, therefore, a catastrophe theory for a hypermodern culture and society, which is imploding into the seductive simulacra of its own dark and negative sign.
So, is that all pretty obvious to you?
Well, no, there's a lot here.
Right, well, if you think of disappearance, my use of the term disappearance, and Virilio writing about disappearance, but McLuhan wrote about the discarnate body as disappearance of time and space. If you just take that basic, easier, simpler terminology from McLuhan and project it on this, you start to see something. You can understand it. But Coker is moving beyond it into the chip world, the chip technology, which props up everything: economy, pollution, health, wealth, medicine. Everything has explosions of progress.
It's a retrieval of that which came before the disappearance.
Right.
But it's a tinier, more homeopathic.
Well, those are my terms. It's on my chart. I have the Orphic Baroque spirals. But let's just say it is taking everything that went before and genetically modulating it. But the genetics broader than that. It's a technological chip environment that's modulating not just the genetic manipulation of bodies, but of
the
whole institutions.
The mimetic manipulation of memes, in the sense that a meme is to a gene as a...
I would say just it's a hyper version of what McLuhan wrote about. Hyper in the sense that all the institutions and previous media are sent into hyper-production.
You know, why is that? I mean, if we're in the disappeared zone, why is Croker trying to go faster and faster with, you know, panic music?
Because it's like a speed-up of McLuhan's point that every environment eats the previous environment, turns the previous environment into material to be processed. So, the chip...
But McLuhan pointed out that the environment disappeared.
The way to visually describe the environment disappeared.
Hmm.
There's a new environment, is you have to use a different means of measuring it or noticing it. You can't use visual or acoustic.
Yeah.
So Croker is... But the reappearance caused by the chip seduction, chip technology propping up the human scale again, or apparent human scale... Like Reagan saying, America's back, you know, after being wiped out in the 60s and 70s, there's a institutional reinvigoration, which Croker would call a virtual landscape. That is what's being represented or reappeared. So with that in mind, let's go through it with that in mind, you know, see if it says it. For who can now speak with confidence of the future of a postmodern scene when what is truly fascinating is the thrill of catastrophe? Now, what he means there is that the disappearance and then reappearance gets recycled, and so you have a faster process of appearance and disappearance. So we begin to enjoy the catastrophes of transitory disappearances because we know we're going to be reappeared.
Mm.
Things have sped up by the 80s a lot more than in McLuhan's time.
Well, let me refer to something I think McLuhan said, if I'm not mistaken, when he saw Kubrick's 2001 Space Odyssey, where Kubrick has the space guy going into the time warp, and it's going faster and faster and faster until he breaks through. And McLuhan said that going faster and faster and faster is not a good metaphor, because we've already broken through to
simultaneity. That's kinetic, hyperkinetic movement, whereas we have moved into the silent instant communication. Mm-hmm. We're in touch and don't need to move anymore.
Right.
So, okay. Now, McLuhan has in one Laws of Media, tetrad on tactile space and tactility, flips into, when it's really intensified, like in the TV age, flips into kinetic space. That's why I describe Croker as kinetic, put that particular old chemical body sense on his quadrant in the chart. But Croker is dealing with a hyperkinetic, and it's the churning the discarnate level faster, as you will. So what you have is that people know not to accumulate. Executives realize you get in the position of elite management. You use the company's money to parachute into other companies. And so you have upward mobility and hypermobility of the executive class.
Mm-hmm.
They're not there to accumulate. They're just there to get the information and knowledge of that company and the contacts and networks, and that allows you to drop that company and move to another company. So that's what Croker is talking about, in the will to accumulation flips into disaccumulation, not holding on anymore.
Mm.
So all that New Age idea in the Thompson era of letting go and all that, that became practical political maneuvering.
Mm.
They're all using the Zen ideology for managing the hyper world of the chip technology. So he says here, so we have what is truly fascinating is the thrill of catastrophe, and where what drives onward economy, so what drives economy, politics, culture, sex, and even eating, is not the will to accumulation. Think of anorexia, and what's the other one begins with B?
Bulimia,
where people eat and then throw up. And even eating is not the will to accumulation, or the search for lost coherency. The search for lost coherency is part of the dialectic of enlightenment. Trying to find out that traditional visual bias knowledge. You'll find out where we came from and where we're going and what is the meaning of our roots in relation to today. That's all dropped and forgotten, because just what is driving the postmodern scene is the opposite. The ecstatic implosion of postmodern culture into excess, waste, and disaccumulation, which is another way to describe the thrill of catastrophe and turnover. So we know in general in the 70s, 80s, 90s, the common complaint for North Americans was, I'm so stressed out because there's so much to do and so many things going on, I can't keep up. That's the common cliche street version of what Croker is describing in terms of the effects and causes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when he says, when technology of the quantum order, it's like invisible computer, you don't know what makes Windows 95 better than the previous Windows. It just does. It's been mutated by technicians, by invisible knowledge. So technology of the quantum order produces human beings who are part metal and part flesh. Some of these you had heart pacers, and things starting to be implanted through advanced medical technology. When robo beings constitute the growing majority of a Western culture which fulfills, then exceeds, Weber's grim prophecy of the coming age of specialists without spirit, which is like the industrial bias, right? Specialists without spirit. Everybody becomes a hyper-specialist without spirit, not just in traditional industrial knowledge, but in all activities. It's called niche marketing. Marketing to demographics. So the whole process and warning of Weber has been exceeded. And when chip technology finally makes possible the fatal fusion of molecular biology and technique, that's genetic engineering, then ours is genuinely a postmodern condition marked by the deepest and most pathological symptoms of nihilism. In other words, McLuhan's principle that every technology wrecks the society it's invented in has now reached hyper 24/7 speeds in the 80s, and so what destroyed the 60s in the 70s? What happened in the 70s that destroyed the 60s, technologically speaking, is now eaten by the 80s. And then, or let's say the first half of the 80s, and the second half of the 80s eat the first half of the 80s. It's speeding up. And so that was quite destructive, and what's called nihilism, it doesn't seem to have any purpose other than energy excess or leading and coming from nothing. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Nihil, nothing. Comes from the word nothing. Not just science is the will to power, which was the traditional early part of the 20th century, but also medicine is an empty will to knowledge of the lacerated body. Medicine, hospitals became geared to more expensive equipment, and the patients had to be adapted to the equipment rather than the patients being served. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the patient is the lacerated body. And so you have all this new surveillance equipment, technology, and chip application coming in, and so they use the penal institutions to experiment and apply it. Penology is a grisly will to surveillance of the body politic. It's like a laboratory to figure out what you're going to do when you wire up to the non-prison areas of cities.
Mm.
And ethics itself is the nucleus made subquantum, or quantum, subatomic, within the dynamic language of instrumental activism. Instrumental activism is all the older technologies going through incredible development to the point of a human scale is lost because it's developing itself. And ethics take the idea of the bottom line. Bottom line is what must be adhered to regardless of Wall Street raiders taking over companies, budget cutting, streamlining, downsizing, and then selling it rapidly.
So this is where the chemical body becomes a servo mechanism for the evolving chip landscape.
Now, do it this way. The institutions that the chemical body created in the 19th and 20th century become the content. What do you say the chemical body is? It becomes the servo mechanism. And so Wall Street becomes a hyper-economy that is, in the 80s, starts from 82, 83, starts going way beyond the standard Wall Street or Dow Jones measurement of 1,000 or 500. That was the range in the 60s and 70s. But, you know, by the end of the 80s, it's up to, 5,000 or something. I can't remember where it goes nuts. Maybe it's only... don't know where it is by 92, but it's now at 11,000 or so, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it went from modulating between 500 and 1,000 in the 70s to making leaps of 1,000 each year through the 80s. So that's the dynamic language of economic instrumental activism. So for most older institutions for the chemical body, it's a catastrophe everywhere. So he says the postmodern scene is therefore a catastrophe theory. So he's proposing that there's a catastrophe everywhere and that there is a fascination and a thrill in catastrophe for a hyper-modern culture. That's not modern, but hyper-modern, and it's like a stage just before postmodern, hyper-modern culture. So therefore, a catastrophe theory for a hyper-modern culture, like the hyper-modern, is going to be wiped out as we move into the postmodern, which is the quantum.
Well, this sounds like the build-up to
the postmodern,
the 90s, computer pyramid bust.
Yeah. The postmodern, you had a bust in 87, right? The computers protested, according to Croker, and crashed. They formed a Paris commune, him being interested in the Paris, or traditional left of Paris. He uses that metaphor from the 1870-71 rebellion in Paris called the Paris Commune. He said the computers created a Paris Commune in October 87 and had Black Monday. They crashed themselves.
Uh-huh.
And then you had the later dot-com crash, 13 years later. The postmodern scene is therefore a catastrophe theory for a hypermodern culture and society which is imploding into the seductive simulacra of its own dark and negative sign. So the idea is if everything's disappeared, then what is left is the after image and that becomes a dark version of what went before. The after image is dark, and it's just a simulacra, but a fascinating one, made up of the thrill of catastrophe and the culture of excess waste and disaccumulation. Follow?
Yeah, sort of.
Like, I mean, the '60s was the pinnacle of progress in technology under the positive sign.
Mm-hmm.
The light and light and positive rather than dark and negative.
Right.
But that was a dialectic, in a way that was a dialectic of enlightenment projected by Tim Leary or all kinds of culture heroes like the feminists, Black Power.
Well, McClure said the ratio of proportions among the media mix was balanced in a way that was conducive to
positive. You're right. Yeah. In the 50s and 60s, there was positive optimism.
Mm-hmm.
But by the 80s, that's been totally destroyed, because the Thomistic idea of balance of ratios becomes superseded by the Android meme or the chip landscape. It's just excess. It's just the point of no return. Endless digestion. So the balance that McLuhan saw in the 1560s in the media environments and their interplay was because we didn't modulate the environments as McLuhan recommended. We went into hyper traction, hyper paralysis, and hyper overdrive, which was facilitated by the chip.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
You can follow what I'm saying. I'm saying right.
This is before, and this is the chip before the internet, actually.
Yes, yeah. This is the 80s.
Yeah.
Croker goes on to describe the 90s in his book, The Data Trash. It comes out about 94. But when I say right, I go right. I mean, you understand what I'm saying. I don't mean
I agree
that that's right.
Yeah, no, I understand.
Yeah.
So, what's going on with the existentialist movement? Are they still fighting for a voice while the postmodernists are getting up and running, or are they already sitting on the sidelines?
Yeah, many of the postmodernists, Baudrillard and them, critiqued Sartre and the existentialists. They came out of that world in the 50s, and when the May 68 student and who else worker revolt happened in Paris, many of the Marxist, existentialist, philosophical, non-capitalist movements thought there was going to be a revolution, and there wasn't. And so everybody reassessed. French thinkers like Baudrillard, Derrida, Barthes, Foucault, Deleuze and Guattari, Virilio started to reassess what the heck were we believing in and why didn't the revolution happen. And that's where postmodernism came from. So it was a critique of the French existentialist tradition.
How did the existentialist tradition differ from the subsequent postmodern thinkers?
Well, existentialism would be...
Now that would have followed on the heels of, like, the nominalists, right?
Yeah, the existentialists said there were no enlightenment values you could use anymore, no humanist values. I don't know if Sartre read Adorno and Horkheimer, but they're all part of the same era, in the late 40s, early 50s. But the existentialists were responding to the radio and TV environment, maybe the radio environment, where you couldn't... It's the early phase of the principle of uncertainty. You couldn't use normal cultural value system. You just explored the present, and generally with nausea. You probed. And so McLuhan comes along and says, well, the reason they're probing is they're a servo mechanism of the effect of radio and early TV. And the postmodernists notice McLuhan.
So they're saying there's no connectedness anymore. Otherwise, when you have connectedness, you can fall back on reason.
When you have human scale or a social community.
Yeah.
The existentialist now is dealing with where's the community?
Mm-hmm.
We're on our own. Now, the McLuhan critiqued that by giving the ground for that philosophical movement of existentialism. And the Baudrillard, Virilio, and the postmodernists noticed McLuhan, who was translated in the late 60s, and featured a lot in the Expo 67 in Montreal, which, you know, the Quebecers, the French, European French, were identifying with because their cousins were in Quebec. So the promotion of McLuhan there, and then the translation of McLuhan and James Joyce in the late 60s, 67, 68, and these French guys had the first time that they could read Joyce, all those factors made them at least think about McLuhan and then translate him or correct him, whatever they thought they were going to do, and that moved them past the existentialist tradition in France.
Mm. And why does all this come out of all this philosophy coming out of France?
Well, because now, in McLuhan terms, my theory is that every culture since the electric tactility threatened every culture. It was a new environment that no culture could contain or have values that related to it. So every culture in the world leaped into its opposite. So in the general principles, the East went west and the west went east, but the oral verbal culture of France flipped into hyper-abstract visual writing. And they became the new progenitors and creators of books that became ground for American academia in the 80s.
Hmm.
Whereas, what did the British do? They were not as oral as the French, oral and verbal. They were visual. So they flipped into the Beatles. Rock and roll. They went oral. So you can look at